Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport. Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, and once again, we are talking about recruiting as the month of August winds down. We get closer to September 1st, and this time I am joined by Bellarmine head coach Andy Whitley. Coach Whitley, thank you so much for joining us from beautiful Louisville, Kentucky.
Appreciate you having me.
Yeah, no doubt. So you've listened to some of these conversations that I've had previously, and I want to keep with this kind of theme or method or kind of structure of the conversation to talk about it chronologically. And, you know, one of the elements of your career and trajectory that I think is not only something that really interests me, but also one of the reasons that, you know, we forged the relationship that we have over the last, you know, 6-7 years is because you have a relatively non-traditional path. You didn't get into coaching immediately. Tell us a little bit about your playing days and then your career before becoming a full-time college lacrosse coach.
Well, I played at Franklin and Marshall, but that was a little bit of a roundabout process. I ended up kind of playing my 2 years, the 2 years that I really did kind of play for Frank Federaca in 95 and 96 when I graduated from Franklin and Marshall. Before that, I had gone to Franklin and Marshall out of high school. It had not really been a great fit out of the gate. I transferred to Alfred University in upstate New York and played for their longtime head coach, Al Brown. Spent 2 years there. Actually had one of the more interesting conversations, and it really has kind of directed a lot of my interactions with kids moving forward, is I asked him what I needed to do to get on the field. And he was very direct with me in terms of the response and said, you know, listen, we think you're a great kid. You're a great asset to the program, good student, et cetera, but we just don't see you playing for us. And it was hard to hear at the time, but it really was very helpful because it was very honest. And I could kind of make a decision to stay at Alfred and conclude my career, or I could kind of seek some opportunity to play elsewhere. I ended up ironically going back to Franklin and Marshall, who had had a coaching change at the time, and playing for Frank for 2 years, and was fortunate enough to start an NCAA tournament game there and kind of have a satisfactory conclusion to my career for me. I think that was kind of what I was looking for. I felt like a good play at the high-end Division III level and was able to kind of prove it to myself. I really wasn't trying to prove it to anybody else. I got into the sports agency business with a guy that I had interned with while I was kind of between schools. I was living at home for a semester in the fall of my fourth year. Interned, he offered me a portion of the company, 40% of it. It's in lieu of kind of a salary, which at that point I was like, well, I'm 23. The worst thing that could happen is this thing blows up. And, you know, somebody asks what I've been doing for 2 or 3 years. I feel like that wasn't going to age poorly. It ended up going fairly well. We ended up selling the business after about 5 years. We were a boutique agency. My business partner ultimately was the certified player agent. We were successful enough that we had a couple of guys in the NFL draft, including a guy who was a first rounder. We had a handful of guys go to play in Japan, who at the time, Lloyd Mosby and Jesse Barfield were probably the most recognizable names. Again, my business partner being about 13 years older than I was the certified player agent. And so, you know, it was a great experience, but it's a hard way to make a living. So we transitioned in the early 2000s into real estate and commodity futures trading. Obviously, the run-up from kind of 2001 to 2008 actually proved to be quite beneficial to me. Ironically, in that period of time, I became the managing partner. And then in 2007 or 2006, we kind of reached the end of a project. And I had been coaching at my high school, which was in New Haven, Connecticut. My high school coach was a Yale alum, and Yale at the time under Andy Shea was looking for a goalie coach. And I told my business partner, I kind of want to see what this is like. And I did it for a year for the 2007 season as the volunteer. He and I kind of reached a point where we were finishing up a project, and I said to him, I think I want to give this coaching thing a go to see where it goes. We spent what was ultimately the 2008 season, kind of wrapping up our business practices. I stayed as the volunteer at Yale, finished kind of the business practices, sold off all the things that we had, shook hands with my business partner, and we went on our way. I spent one more season at Yale, being the 2009 season, with Andy. Andy Copeland had gotten hired in the 2009 season, and again, I moved from the volunteer at Yale, where I'd been for 3 years, to the volunteer at Fairfield. Spent 3 years as the volunteer there in the 10, 11, and 12 seasons. I was on a little bit of a crossroads in the 2012 season because Fairfield was coming off what I still believe is the best Fairfield team ever. We were 12-4, had lost in the conference championship game to Loyola of Maryland, who ultimately went on to win the national championship game. And we will always believe we got snubbed that year. I think, you know, we were on the outside looking in. I think we were one of the last teams that the committee was thinking about, but it was a wildly successful year. And I hadn't been able to kind of get one of those paid jobs. I interviewed, ironically, at Washington and Jefferson, which is a Division III school at the time. There was a gentleman who was the AD there, named Bill Duquette, who I had one of the more influential interviews of my professional life there. And it was just it was very impactful. It made me realize I want to stay in coaching. And I really did want to stay in, ironically, at the Division I level. Some circumstances at Fairfield changed. Andy offered me one of the full-time positions that had opened up that summer. And I spent 4 years as a full-time assistant, 3 more years as the associate head coach. Andy resigned. They made some changes in the coaching staff at Fairfield, and fortunately, I became the head coach here in the fall or the summer of 2019.
And so, that's where I want to start this conversation in earnest, because you know, everything had unfolded at Fairfield, and you stayed on the recruiting trail, as a lot of guys in that position do. It's a really good opportunity to network. And certainly when the next opportunity comes along, you have to be, you know, well acquainted with the, you know, prospects. And even prior to that, sometimes that becomes a part of the interviewing process. You were at the, I believe it was the National Prep Showcase or National Prep Championship at the Victory Event Series thing at Hill School in Pennsylvania. And that's when we met. And, you know, at this point, Inside Lacrosse was about 3 years into having rolled out our recruiting database, which was essentially, you know, it was then what it is now, which is a way for visitors to our website to navigate the content that we create. And it was kind of all built on this idea that, you know, for 10 or 15 years, we'd had a similar model of going to events, identifying the 10 or 15 or 25 best players who were there, writing a paragraph about them. And the problem with that was that, you know, that was really newsworthy for a couple days. And then once it fell off the front page of the website, it was basically never to be seen from again, despite the fact that the athlete has a 5 or 6 year arc of relevance, and sometimes much longer than that. And so we created this portion of our website that was meant to be associated with the player. And so this paragraph of text required some attributes to be associated with it in order to yield a score, because there's so much more that you can do with that number than you can do with just a description of the player style. And then you can proliferate it. And that number has application all across, you know, different elements of his high school team, his club team, and his future college team once he commits, and on the women's side as well. And it had been a little bit of a slog to really aggregate critical mass of an input of these evaluations. And so when we spoke, you know, we covered a lot of ground, but I remember, you know, saying like, hey, I'm really interested in somebody being able to produce these player evaluations for us. You obviously are tremendously qualified by virtue of your experience as a coach, and you want to be on the trail. I can make it worth your while. And so over the course of that month, that really kind of June of 2019, you changed the identity of our database. And then you ended up becoming the head coach of a Division I team, and we lost this resource. That being said, there were a lot of things that, you kind of shared with me and some questions that I shared with you at the time that I think form an interesting baseline for this conversation. So before diving in on any of that individually, is there anything that you remember about that that kind of rises above the rest or is a little bit more prominent or preeminent?
Well, two things I remember about it is one, I knew you and I had spoken about it shortly before that, before we had met, and it was, you had kind of described it to me, and I was like, oh, that in my head, I felt like that's Tom Lemming back in the 60s is what I felt like the genesis was. And I feel like lacrosse, and I still do to an extent, like lacrosse is in the 40s and 50s relative to football, where college lacrosse is still a little bit bigger than the pros, but the pros is starting to burgeon and become very relevant. So I was like, you're a little bit ahead of your time. But then I also saw why you felt like it would work. But I just didn't know who you would use to be able to do that. Cause as a college coach, I really didn't feel like I had as a potential person to do it. I didn't feel like I would have enough time as a qualified person. And then sure enough, circumstances dictated that I had plenty of time to do it. And the circumstances were absolutely appropriate for me to do it. And I remember thinking it was great because you go to these events and you evaluate players when you don't really have a team to evaluate them for. It's hard to evaluate them because I'm going to evaluate a kid very differently at Yale because we're going to have certain things that we would be looking for than I would at Fairfield. And I know that certain kids will have a certain level of interest by virtue of, you know, strata of school and strata of brand recognition. And when I didn't have a school to kind of tie the evaluation to, it was a little bit of a crapshoot. You know, this guy's really good, but is it a guy worth us chasing as a program? Well, I don't have a program. So it was a little bit of an empty period. And then when you offered that up, one, it was like very selfishly was going to help me defray some of the expenses traveling across the Eastern Seaboard trying to go to all these events. But secondly, it was very purposeful for me. I would go to an event, I would evaluate guys relative to the format that you had laid out to me. We would caucus, make sure that it fit with what you were trying to do and you could fit and it was publishable within the format that you were hoping to produce. And then I could go back and write it up and send it to you. So it gave me a purpose at the event. And I do remember a couple of the, one of the ones I remember, and I want to say it was CJ Kirst that we had talked about, who I know is obviously, I think, a junior now or even a senior at Cornell. He had not played well at a tournament, or he played very pedestrian. And he was he was obviously CJ Kirst. He's a wonderful college player. And you and I had gone through some of the ratings, and that one, it stood out to you, was a little bit low. And because it was hypercritical of him, and it was interesting to me. I was like, oh yeah, I have to kind of recognize that this has a certain degree of entertainment component. You are trying to sell a potential product component. So it was a learning process for me too. And it actually was helpful for me in tempering some of my own evaluations as a coach. You sometimes over evaluate or over critical of certain kids to the point you talk yourself out of them. And I never ended up being a part of a program that had any tangible recruitment of him, but like he's a player that I think anybody in college lacrosse would take at this point. Even then I kind of knew he was going to be a good player, and the rating I gave him was kind of laughable when you think about it now. I think it was like a 68 or a 70, which I kind of, when I think back on, I was like, yeah, he can go into the pile of kids that I've kind of screwed up in terms of evaluation in my lifetime for that particular one. Though he has turned into be obviously a terrific player.
One of the things that you said at the time that I have talked to so many of your peers about is just so there's essentially two or three tiers to this, depending on how you frame it. So the first is guys who recruit that essentially don't have a system or a process, right? So it kind of speaks to that notion of a descriptive paragraph of text. And it leads to a very kind of gut feel decision-making process on, is this somebody that I'm going to pursue, or is this somebody that I'm going to offer an opportunity to? And then there is the next layer where there is a system or a process, but it would be pretty subjectively called bad, right? It just doesn't, you know. It's, I always use the Michael Scott reference from The Office, where when Pam is keeping score at beach day, it's like you gave a thumbs up, a check mark, and a heart sign. Like, what is that supposed to mean? And look for the conversion of Stanley Nichols to U.S. dollars. But the third tier are folks who do have a system, and it is systematized, particularly within a staff and across multiple evaluators on staff, which I think is so essential to be able to try to make 1+1+1 and now 1+1+1+1 equal 5 or more. And so I think, and this was 5 years ago, so, or 4 years ago, so I might be misremembering it, but I was flattered that you said something to the effect of, this is forcing me to be a little bit more systematized in how I go about this. How do you remember evaluating when you were at Fairfield, and how does it compare to how you evaluate now at Bellarmine?
When I was at Fairfield, Andy Copeland is very much into the feel category, but I also think he has a photographic memory. So a lot of times we could tell him one piece of information, he would remember it, and we would basically like feed him information, and then he would extrapolate it and process it how he felt was appropriate. And he would remember it all. That was always the thing that struck me. And we had like a systemic board where we would have a handful of guys that us as assistants felt were Division I caliber players that we think would come to Fairfield for a variety of reasons, whether we'd spoken to the kid, we'd spoken to his club coach, some combination thereof, they'd submitted transcripts to us, et cetera. And I remember about once a week, Andy would come into the office, our assistant's office, and chat with us for a few minutes, and then he'd stare at the board for 30 minutes. And then I almost feel like at some point about 2 days later after that, he would come back and be like, set up a visit with this kid, and this kid. And then, so we were basically funneling all the information to him. He would process it, which he would do at an extremely high level. And then, you know, kind of, we would be responsible for getting the kids in front of him to finish the process. And it yielded, obviously, some extraordinary teams at Fairfield. We were, you know, 6 consecutive years in the conference tournament, 4 years in the 4 out of those 6 years, we ended up in the conference championship game, and it just kind of fit for who our ultimate decision maker was. And so we kind of tailored our recruiting to that. Like, let's go get the guys that we can get him the information, and then let him funnel it down in the art of recruiting. I did learn based on how he recruited, like, you're typically looking for a lefty attackman. You need a ball carrier, typically who can dodge below the cage. Even in those days, you know, your best athletes needed to be between the restraining lines. You needed a number one type cover defenseman. You typically needed a ground ball defenseman. A lefty in there was very helpful. Goalies and faceoff guys were force multipliers. Those are things that I always knew from Andy, that are kind of archetypes for the sport. What the process did with Inside Lacrosse did for me was actually give me a little bit more kind of bumper rails for me to streamline a process for myself, particularly once I got this job. And so I'm a little bit more structured, but we do fall into the art of recruiting. There is a little bit, it's not as structured as I have heard others talk about, where we assign a rating to guys, where this guy is a, you know, a 5, this guy is a 4.8, and we deem a 4.8 better than a 4.7. I think that we are, one of the overreaching things that I took from Andy and I became a believer in, and it is translated here, and it's why I don't wholly quantify everything we do in recruiting, is we are still in the people business. So people that relate to me and my staff don't always relate to other people. I've made a commitment to myself, my staff, that we're going to coach kids and families that we like. We spend so much time with them. We spend 2, 3, 4 hours a day during the season. We spend, you know, countless hours just, you know, them coming into the office to ask questions. I want to be around kids And my staff wants to be around kids that we really enjoy being around, that we like. I think forcing a square peg into a round hole is a waste of time because there are so many good lacrosse players. And we really kind of band guys. You know, there's an elite band. There's a band where a majority of our kids seem to come from here at Bellarmine. There's a low band and there's a group of no's. We don't split hairs a lot in the band. Once we kind of deem a kid is in a band, if we get him, then it's like, is he interested in us? You know, and if he's interested in us and he, you know, comes visit, sends a transcript, well, we have enough confidence in ourselves as coaches that we think we can get the best version of that kid, whatever it is. So Inside Lacrosse was really helpful for me for almost creating the band system. But the band system still is very subjective because I still have a little bit of Andy Copeland to my recruiting process where there's an art to it, not a science, because I could assemble a team of guys that I recruited that nobody wanted that turned out to be ridiculous lacrosse players. And I could also assemble a team of guys that I didn't think or thought we should pass on who turned out to make me look extraordinarily foolish for saying that out loud. So I think I still believe it's an art and I still believe we're in the people business. So I tend to shy away from over quantifying it. And there's no specific timeline to it either because kids go through the process and they get interested in schools at different times. And if a guy who falls into the band, you know, is interested in your school and wants to come and he's at the top band, you know, not everybody's going to get the same kind of the same opportunity to get to the table. You know, I can't wait for those guys because this guy's pretty good. You know, so it's like we may be splitting 1%. And if I wait too long, I might have to drop 10% because all the guys in that band go away because they don't think we're interested. So I ironically, you know, I spent 3 years with Andy Shea, who is a hyper kind of active, you know, quantifier of things. He is elite at that. You guys helped me kind of bring that back into my recruiting process as an individual. And I think it's helpful for us to create the band. But once we got like this guy's an A band kid, we don't overcook it at that point. At that point, like if we agree he's an A band, then we put him in the A band and go next steps from there.
You brought up something that I want to revisit, which is you described the essentially roles that you're trying to build a roster to. And one of the things that really stood out to me when you were, you know, producing all these player evaluations was the lens through which you were looking at these individuals and it was about the game. And that was what was so interesting to me was that the shot clock had just been implemented and the first season with a shot clock had just concluded. And you probably produced about 400 to 500 player evaluations in a month. And of those 400 to 500, I would estimate that you included in the shot clock era, like that phrase, in 20% of them. And what was so revealing was the way in which you were internalizing how the game had fundamentally changed. I don't really have a specific question about that, but I wanted to share that anecdote as I lead to this next question, because I think that it's reflective of your approach. So you get the opportunity to be the head coach at Bellarmine. Anybody that's ever looked at Bellarmine's roster sees that you can reach into literally every single pocket of the sport. And that's So you have, you know, MIAA conference players, you've got New England prep school players, you've got, you know, I don't know whether you have a Long Island public school kid on your team right now, but I'm sure that you've had the opportunity to have, you know, Long Island public school kids on your team. And then, of course, you've got Canadians. I think you've got 5 Californians on your team. You've got folks from, you know, obviously Ohio and Kentucky, and then all throughout the Midwest and the South. How do you go about trying to cast such a wide net when you're just, you know, 3 or, you know, potentially now 4 guys?
I think that's a product of who my staff and I are. I think we seek out geographic diversification as a staff.
And before we move on, can you tell us a little bit about who your staff is?
So my associate head coach is Nick Marks. He was a longtime defensive coordinator at Bucknell, played and coached with Frank Federaca, who I played and coached for. So there's obviously a connection there. And I got to know him through Fairfield and Bucknell playing each other for a number of years. He became the head coach at Whittier College in California, which at one point had the most diverse, culturally diverse roster in the country. He and I remained friendly, but ideologically we fit very similarly. My offensive coordinator is Mike Andrusik. He is also a Bucknell graduate, played and coached under Nick, played under him at Bucknell, coached under him at Whittier. And Jackson Draper, who is from Colorado, who is our third assistant, and he actually played for Nick at Whittier as well. And I think ideologically, we enjoy a very educated, very geographically, experientially diverse roster, as well as a culturally diverse roster. So I think ideologically, we aspire to that. I think Louisville is a very progressive city as just a general living environment. And it's ironic, we are in Kentucky, which I think a lot of people would consider a very southern state, but we're right on the Ohio River across from Indiana, which I don't think anybody would consider a southern state. I think they would consider it a Midwestern state. And so we tend to be a Midwestern city in a southern state. And so it's a very just progressive environment. It is a college town. The University of Louisville is a major presence in the city. And I swore I wasn't going to make that part of my recruiting pitch when I took the job. But then I went to like four football games my first fall. And I was like, who am I kidding? This is what people do here. It's a college sports town. So we really kind of took to let's sell. Like, that's a pretty cool environment. You have big college sports town experience with a small college, you know, the small college learning environment. We're a 3,000 person school. And it was very similar to a Whittier, to a Bucknell, to a Fairfield in terms of size and scope. You know, certainly had a little bit of a slant to Fairfield, obviously, with the Catholic affiliation. Our president is the former dean of students at Loyola of Maryland, was there for 30 years, was part of that senior administration that gave rise to their national championship. And her name is Susan Donovan. So there were a lot of just similarities of goal in terms of what we were trying to accomplish. And I think the program that we would be the most comfortable with. The next step was who's going to be interested in coming here. And we cast a very wide net because I couldn't sell historical success. I was selling the entrepreneurial spirit that I started my professional life with. And I think it appealed to my staff, which is why they came to work here. And I think it's appealed to the kids that have come here, but that's not regionally specific. You know, we have kids who are in a lot of ways want to be within about 4 to 6 hours of home. You know, you say, well, Baltimore's not that because we do have a couple of those guys, but it's a 90-minute plane flight.
Right.
You know, California is a, you know, 3.5 hour plane flight. So it's all stuff that can be done in a half day. And it's people that are interested in a city experience in a small college, we have a little bit of a unique kind of ambiance and circumstance. And so I think we've just sought out people that want that experience. I have also sought out people that want to help us win our first conference championship. They don't want the historical foundation already laid. They want to be that type of, they want to be the kid that you talk about in 20 years. They want to be on that team. So that's kind of what we have sold. Ironically, I have not really tried to recruit north of New York City. So I haven't gone after Long Island directly, and I haven't gone into New England because I think those kids have so many options before they get to us that I don't want to kind of, I think we're overselling to do it. Those kids have obviously had some interest, and we do have kids on our roster from those locations, as you pointed out, but they have typically found us. So I have typically in those particular regions recruited the kids that have recruited us because they typically have a reason to be here. And then if they slip into the band where we think they're good enough, then we've already kind of jumped a major hurdle. That may shift a little bit. Coach Andrusik spent a lot of time in New England and Long Island and the Northeast this year, a little bit more so than normal. We seem to be generating some interest, so that may have had a direct effect. But I think we've kind of planted flags in the Midwest and the South. You know, Coach Marks is from the Chicago area. You know, I think if we do well in the Minnesota, south all the way to Texas area. I think that's a very large, very strong lacrosse area for us to build from. And he's kind of winning, helping us win our backyard. And we've kind of stretched that all the way to the south as well, you know, into the Georgia and the Florida area as well. So we've just kind of looked for identity and for ideology more so than location. And it's just a little bit of work. One of the things I do systemically is every guy on staff has to do 5 recruiting contacts of some kind per night, but you never do more than 90 minutes. And the reason I say that is you can do the math easily as I can. It's, you know, now it's 20 people that we contact every day, with 4 people being able to do it. 30 days a month, we can contact 600 people every month. We can get some kind of contact out to that. So we get to 1,200 people we've had contact with by November. And it's helpful because I also don't want to burn guys out, so we do put a time limit on it. And sometimes those 5 contacts will take 5 seconds because you send 5 texts, no one responds, you're done. Sometimes you have 5 20-minute phone conversations. Well, that'll get you to your hour and a half. So I try to keep it sustainable but consistent. And that's why I think we're able to cast such a wide net and have such a far reach. It's been successful in the sense that we have 20 states and 3 Canadian provinces on the 2023 roster. The 24 roster, I have to kind of do the math again on it. But we are eventually going to add a kid from Missouri, I believe, who is a committed kid. And so I think that number is probably going to be pretty consistent. You'll see 20 states, you know, 2 to 3 Canadian provinces, that neighborhood pretty much every year. But that's just, it's an identity that we are seeking out. You know, one of my pitches is, you know, I can't dump out a bunch of championship rings on a table and tell you everybody in the last 15 years has gotten one of these. And that's where you as the player come in. I'm hoping 15 years from now I can say that. And then I'm going to change my recruiting pitch because then it'll be kind of weird if I say that. But now the kids that find that appealing, that's who's saying yes to us right now. And that's who we are relatable to. You know, that kind of visionary mindset.
Do you evaluate these kids differently as players? Do you build in essentially more upside if they come from non-traditional programs or are 2 or 3 sport athletes and haven't dedicated themselves to lacrosse full time?
I value athleticism first. I think I don't differentiate between 3 sport athletes and 1 sport athletes. I think if a kid wants to play 3 sports, he should play 3 sports because it makes him happy. If a kid wants to play 1 sport, he should play 1 sport because it makes him happy. I think highly enough of myself and my coaches as talent developers that I think we can turn kids into the best version of themselves. And I think it's athleticism and athletic potential that we evaluate first and foremost. The interesting part about it is, you know,
And let me interrupt and say that this is something that probably could or should have come up 20 minutes ago in this conversation, but that is another aspect of like our getting to know or my getting to know you as an evaluator that really appealed to me is that I think, you know, in the first few podcasts, I talked about it as a spectrum between production at one end and athletic potential at the other end. And I definitely fall more at the end of the athletic potential end of the spectrum and you do as well. And so it's been fun to watch you build your rosters over the course of the last few years because it kind of does feel like, man, if I was in that position, I think that my team would look pretty similar to that just because I value those types of players similarly to the way that you value them too. So continue.
I always think like you can't teach a kid to be 6'3". You can make a kid a little bit faster, but if he runs a 4.7, like I can't teach him to run that. So I think those are quintessential pieces for us. And then we can teach you to play lacrosse. The other thing is football is having a participation rate that is declining at a pretty precipitous rate. Those kids are going somewhere and they seem to be going to lacrosse. And football is the most athletic, most weight room intensive, biggest, strongest, fastest sport that we have as a country right now. And I think we're looking for kids that fit into that prototype because it is a contact sport. And I think kids who spend time in the weight room and who want life in the weight room and who want to eat like Division I athletes and lift and work out like Division I athletes, those are the kids that are going to survive Division I lacrosse. because it is a extremely athletic sport. You have the power and strength component of football and the cardiovascular component of basketball and soccer. And so, like, kids who come into this and think they're going to eat less than 6,000 calories a day and survive are extremely naive. It is ultimately, like, the injury rate's going up in our sport. Like, when I got here, you know, 4 years ago, we had 41 guys on the roster. And the last practice I had before COVID ended, we had 32 guys healthy to play. So, like, we couldn't scrimmage. This past year, this current team will have 58 guys on the roster. You know, we have our run test scheduled for Monday. I think we're only going to have 48 guys run it. Like, we just have a series of injuries. Guys are banged up. A couple of guys have played in the Minto Cup. So they're obviously a little bit, we may hold them out just as a preventative piece. But nonetheless, 20% of our roster isn't going to participate in our run test and probably not be at practice the first time we do stick work. So I do go back to one of the things I also feel is a responsibility. And it's ironic, as I evaluate athleticism, I also evaluate, can I provide kids opportunity to achieve what they want to achieve? I am not going to guarantee anybody the outcome, but I will. I think it's a responsibility to provide them the opportunity. And in the context of us saying, yes, we look hard. Does this kid, in our mind as coaches, where's the real window that we believe he will have a chance to earn his minutes? Some guys are day one. That's a very real thing. Some guys, we feel like we're recruiting 3-year starters. If I have this year is a good example, we have 3 returning attackmen that scored 130 goals. I don't know, you know, certainly we brought in some guys I think are pretty talented. I'm not expecting anybody to start at attack as a freshman this year. But injuries could cause that. But if things go the way I would like it, we've recruited a bunch of 2-3 year starters, potentially 4-year if the kids come in next year. But that's what the pipeline looks like. And I try to articulate that to kids too, but some of it's factoring in their athletic development along the way too. Like, I don't really need you to be athletically ready till year 2, because that's when we think we're going to need you.
How has it changed in the 4 years? Obviously, I would imagine tremendously impacted during the summer of 2020 by your inability to get out on the road, and then, you know, equivalently, similarly in 21. And then in addition to that, the program has found success and you've learned better who is going to tend to want to come to Bellarmine, and you've learned how to tell the story of the experience better, which you already have on this podcast. So how has volume of conversation, quality of conversation, quality of player that you're able to have a conversation with, how has it evolved over the last 4 years?
Well, the quality of player has gotten markedly better. We've gotten much, much more finished, closer to a finished product. But, you know, not everybody wants to travel. The volume has gone up, and we've had to kind of sift through more people that are interested in our program. Because I think we're new. I think we're a little bit trendy at the moment. Having had some recent success, everyone's kind of curious about us. So the volume, as I said, and the quality, I think, has gone up. And so the challenge for us has been to continue to find the right kids. I stole this from Chris Peterson, the old Washington football coach. We really are trying to recruit OKGs. It's the acronym for our kind of guys. And the mistake you can fall into is, when you have some success, people are more interested in being a part of it. And so you don't have to look as hard to find really good players that are interested in your program, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't recruit the same kids. Because those are the kids that are going to fit in your identity, fit in your locker room, that will ultimately become the best team. I am not trying to build an all-star team. I am trying to build the best team. We have passed on players who are extraordinarily talented and have scored massive numbers of goals against us and have stopped us from scoring goals because I don't think they would fit here. And they've gone on to success at other places, and I still don't think they would have fit here. It would have been nice to have their talent, but I'm not going to try to be all things to all people. My staff is not going to try to be all things to all people. We just are who we are. And I try to be very transparent with families, with the kids, about what to expect when they're here, because of the fact that I think we are just appealing to, you know, guys who have a little bit of a vision. I can't guarantee the outcome. Failure is a part of this thing. That's the thing I want guys to understand, is you can come here, have a wonderful career, and it still not work out.
It's a great opportunity to bring up something that I think, I don't know, like, these podcasts are informative. They're not advertisements, right? Like, I'm not giving you free space to pitch Bellarmine. But at the same time, I also am, I think the whole idea is that, you know, I have parents that ask, like, you know, what should I expect, or like all these other questions. And you know, what it really comes down to is, it's like, I kind of feel like you should already know that, but ultimately, like, it's my responsibility to provide the opportunity to, like, learn that. And one of the elements of this conversation is essentially, I mean, it's balance, right? And it's when you're a college athlete, and particularly a college lacrosse player, realizing the professional and international aspiration relative to other sports, like, you have to put all of that contextually into balance. And I hope you don't mind me sharing that. Obviously, you guys are in a city that's known for one annual tradition that kind of rises above the rest, and it has the potential to conflict with your schedule. And this year, you guys had a really good season, but it ended in a manner where your players were able to participate in that annual event. For me, your attitude for their decision to do that, and what it meant for their process of coping with the end of their season, and how they valued their experience, both in terms of their lacrosse experience and the balance of their lacrosse and non-lacrosse experience at Bellarmine, was really important. So can you tell us a little bit about what I'm talking about?
Well, we lost on Friday, May 5th to Utah, in what was a very well-played, very, very good lacrosse game. We obviously had some chances to win it. Utah was great. They ended up beating us. We packed up, drove home that night, got home fairly late from Pittsburgh. And I met with the guys on Saturday morning, because we obviously have to do some end of the year stuff. But we built it around so the guys could go to the Kentucky Derby, which was on the 6th. They could get out there in the afternoon and do it. Some of it is just kind of seeing the forest from the trees. Our kids had given us an effort that I think was worthy of just worthy of recognition. But it also took a lot out of them. And I think they decompressed. Kids are going to decompress differently than they are, than I would or you would. And so, you know, once they were, you know, I've talked to many coaches who get mad that they, you know, kids don't wallow the way we did. You know, it took 3 days for me to recover from losing a playoff game. That's not the way kids are anymore. So once we kind of got done what we needed to get done, I just felt like, listen, fellas, if this is something you guys want to do, the season's over, go let off some steam. We will get connected with you to do end of the year meetings a week or so out. I need a break, so I'm going to take it. And then you guys can, we will reconvene when it's appropriate and we'll be productive. And they did their thing at Churchill Downs in the Kentucky Derby. And I sat on my couch and I actually didn't even watch it. I swore I'm not going to go to the Kentucky Derby until I retire. Just because it typically will conflict with our conference tournament. But they are different than I am. They are 30 years my junior. And so I'm not going to impose my overall belief system on it. I view like providing a experience for the kids is like driving down a 6-lane highway. There are certainly a lane I'd like to drive in, but the kids provide their own experience. And I think what families need to do is figure out what is the experience like at these respective colleges, and is it something that will resonate with you as a family? Because I think if kids are happy, parents will be happy, and the experience evolves for everyone. Because I also think it is naive to think that at the college level that the kids are full-on adults, much as I would like them to be, and not have interaction with their parents. There are very few kids that are writing the tuition checks. So I think it's important that families kind of be part of the process as a whole, because I think it's naive to think otherwise. So I hope that's the one you were referring to.
It is. It is. And I think that's well said in a number of respects and in a number of fronts. I also have never been to either the Kentucky Derby or the Preakness, despite having lived in Baltimore for now 18 years, because it has always conflicted with my job. But no, I we spoke the next day, and I just really appreciated that openness, right? The opposite of a heavy-handed, you know, it would have been a punishment essentially, right? It's not necessarily a reward to let them go. It's more of a punishment to not let them go. And, you know, that implies that they didn't want to win. Like, you clearly didn't believe that was the case, right? It's like, I always get mad whenever I see a coach yell at somebody for not catching a pass. It's like, do you really think that player didn't want to catch a pass? Like, no, it's just a hard thing to do. And yeah, they need to maintain focus. And sometimes they need to be reminded that they have to focus in order to catch the pass. But your players wanted to win the ASUN championship, and when they didn't, that didn't mean that life stopped. And again, I just, you know, I appreciated that perspective. And I think that, you know, to your latter point about fit relative to this process, you know, I think it's one of the things that if listeners haven't picked up by now, that I'm at least going to start by talking to a coach from one program in each of the 10 conferences. I'm saying that is now the format. It will change once I complete the 10 conferences, but I want to commit to that to start, because it is not formulaic, right? And so, you know, I appreciated what you said earlier about, you know, finding the art in player evaluation and in recruiting. And you know, I certainly think that ascribing a number to a block of text is, you know, it is to a certain degree quantitative, but lacrosse, you know, I think it's interesting that, like, so at one end you have kind of the most objectively evaluated sports, right? So swimming and running, where it's just based on your times, and then, you know, golf and tennis, where it's just based on your scores and you can kind of be whatever, etc., like head-to-head competition, all that sort of stuff. And then, you know, there's the next layer of more objectively evaluated, and I would put football into that category. I would put baseball into that category, where, you know, it's a combination of your athletic attributes and your statistical outputs. And then I would move one step farther, and I would say basketball falls into the next tier, where your athletic attributes are very objectively evaluated, but still there's a lot more relative to the skill-based, you know, thing, the space that you occupy. And then I think hockey, soccer, and lacrosse fall into a similar category, where the athletic attributes and the quantitatively evaluated material are important, but they will never be so much more important or as important as the qualitatively evaluated and the subjectively evaluated aspects of this. And so, you know, I think that idea can be overlaid or protracted into a lot of the other elements of it, right? So, you know, there might be a player who, from both a skill, athleticism, and personality standpoint, you think would be a great fit at Bellarmine, but if they don't think that he would be, or his family would be, a great fit at Bellarmine, it kind of doesn't matter, right? And so, you know, that's where the point that you made that I think is a good note to end on is just that, you know, if the goal of this podcast series is to inform parents and families and kids as to how they should go about expecting and conducting themselves in the process, then certainly one of the most important points to reemphasize and reinforce is if you're good enough to play at the level and you're committed to play at the level, there should be a fit out there for you, because there is so much variety in terms of places that you can end up.
I also think that, to kind of echo what you're talking about, is I think people have to remember it is a job interview too. So it is, you know, go through the process with that same mindset, but evaluate each job interview as you go through it. Because I think people forget, you know, what did you like about that place? What did you not like about that place? And it can help steer the journey for each kid. Because if you don't like a city and another school from a city landscape comes along, you have to think, is that really going to be a fit? You know, if you like the small school thing and a major state school comes along, is that really going to be the fit? Or if you like the suburbs and you have a series of suburbs, then you need to, like, kind of pivot your interest level. And I do think people sometimes, you know, you get criticized as a coach for only recruiting who recruits you. And I think families sometimes make that mistake when you can be a proactive person in your own process, because no one will care about the player's individual process like the player and their families. We care about it as coaches in as much as it will affect us. But the kids themselves care more about their own individual process than anyone else. And I think it's good to remind players and families to just, as it unfolds, like, keep that in mind. Like, you're the one who cares the most, so you need to be an active participant in it.
Andy Whitley, really appreciate your time on the Inside Lacrosse podcast. Really enjoyed the conversation. Can't wait to hopefully visit you in the fall and get an opportunity to check out the Knights as the calendar turns to next spring.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me, Terry.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.